You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org. Hey, dear listeners, welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreeslein with you. Happy to spend the next hour talking outdoor topics. We've got Stan Tequila, who will be with us in a little while. We'll talk some non-game topics with him. Then we'll also have Gord Ellis. I have not had Gord Ellis on in forever. Gord, based out of Thunder Bay. We're mostly going to talk lake trout. I saw lake trout with Gord, and believe it or not, some of that border country, there's still some ice up in Gord's neck of the woods, up towards Thunder Bay. So this, it's prime time, really, to be talking about early lake trout. I've got Tim Lesmeister here in the studio with me for this segment, and of course later in the show too. Tim, it's good to see you in person.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I had a fun opener in Minnesota and decided to stick around for a while before I head down to Iowa here in a couple of days to chase some bass on the farm ponds.
Well, let's talk about that opener. How did it go? It was a windy opener. Glenn Schmidt reporting that across most of the state. The governor had a good time on the St. Croix out of Stillwater. How did you guys do?
I was with my son and my grandsons. We fished a small lake just west of Lake Mille Lacs. It was very windy, of course, for everybody that was out on opener. But, you know, you have to use the wind to your benefit. And as always, I called Mr. Walleye Gary Roach up before the opener, the day before. And I said, what would you do, Gary? What are you going to do? And he says, opening day, because you don't know what's going on, always start shallow and work deep. Now, we were targeting northern pike, bass, and we were going to do some crappie fishing in the afternoon. We started in very shallow water, found nothing. So we fished for probably 2 hours in the very shallow water, nothing. Moved out slowly into deeper water. And when we hit that 11 to 14 foot range, that's where we found our fish. We caught some nice big northern pike. We caught a lot of bass, but we never did find the crappies.
Well, it sounded like a decent opener. It sounded pretty average opener, honestly, across most of the state. But with warming temperatures and this wind laying down, the prospects are very good looking ahead for the rest of the month and into June.
Yeah, I'd say so. I was driving past Mille Lacs a couple of times over the weekend on opener, and that west side of the lake was packed with boats because, you know, windbreak there. Mm-hmm. St. Albans Bay was wall-to-wall, so there were a lot of people out on the big lakes. They didn't let the wind stop them from getting out there to try and chase walleyes. Most of the guys I talked to that were walleye fishing found their fish a little deeper as well. And so the fishing, I thought, was pretty good, but you know, it is truly that first, second week of June when things really open up, and it's going to be a banner year, I think, for just about every species.
There are some headlines I wanted to go over with you, Tim. One, the legislative session wrapping up Sunday, midnight on the 17th, and they still had some work to get done, particularly this Lesard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Fund. That's the money that was dedicated via state sales tax in 2008. Every year we've got this this Outdoor Heritage Council that recommends how funding should be spent, and generally the legislature kind of rubber stamps it. One time about 15 years ago when Phyllis Kahn, I don't know if she was the head of the committee or she was like one of the senior members, they tried to add a couple metro things to it. It was a couple items that the council had not recommended. I don't necessarily think they were bad proposals, but they, you know, we had the governor at Game Fair, and we're talking Dayton, and he was on record as saying he would veto anything that the council didn't recommend, and he did. He vetoed that, and really ever since then, the legislature's played pretty nicely with the Lasard-Sam Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations, and they generally just kind of push them through, maybe, you know, tweak them a little bit, give some positive feedback. Well, this time around, of course, we've got this evenly divided House. We've got some Republicans that want to add some amendments. One, they don't like this one project up in northwestern Minnesota, Roseau River. I guess there's some area landowners, probably some property rights stuff going on with that. I don't know all the details. And then they had two other amendments. One would add term limits to the citizens who are on the council, and the other one would kind of revamp the process for hiring the executive director. So I don't necessarily have a problem with either of those two amendments, but I don't want these amendments bogging down the process to the point that there's $190 million that we need to get in the ground, and I don't want these amendments preventing that from happening. As I said in my column a couple weeks ago, you know, wait till 2027 with these amendments and pass them on their own. I think you probably would get support, but of course, right now it's purely partisan, and we've got Democrats saying they don't like the amendments, Republicans saying they want them, and we're stuck because you need a majority to get it through committee. As of the middle part of this week, no one really knew if we were going to get this done this year.
Yeah, and it scares me, this kind of thing. The legislative bodies always remind me of my son, Jason, who talks about a lot of things that he's going to do and then waits till the very last minute to get it done. And that's just what it is, and that's what they always do. And then what it does is it ends up hurting everything. And, you know, scrambling at the last minute, and anytime you hurry a project, means that you're going to make mistakes and things are going to go wrong. I fear that this isn't going to go out this year, and that money's just going to sit there, like you said, doing nothing.
Outdoor News Radio, Rob Gerisline and Tim Lesmeister are kicking off this week's broadcast. Tim, on to some funner topics. We had young Justin Runberg write a story about smelting on the North Shore. Now, when I was a young kid living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, I remember a couple times my dad bringing home a bunch of smelt and cooking them up. And I remember being a little kid thinking they were delicious. I thought that was great. I moved farther south and really never got back into it. But there's still on the North Shore in that Duluth area a pretty strong tradition of smelting. You're a Lake Superior guy. Ever got into that?
Oh, yes. Years ago. I gave it up because I quit drinking.
Is that kind of part of it, Tim?
Kind of part of the program, as far as I can tell. I mean, this happens at night, so right. You know, it's either let's go to the bar or let's go smelting. And it's pretty much the same stuff happens both places. Some people seine. They actually seine the shoreline. Some people dip them out as they're moving up into the mouths of the rivers to spawn. I think they're spawning. That's why they come in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And people like to eat these things. Cleaning them is really, really tough. You basically, you know, slice them open, use your thumb out the guts. You don't even take the heads off. You just fry them whole. And then it's fun, but it's not. You know, you're up late at night, you're cold, and it's work. You know, I mean, you're filling these 5-gallon buckets up full of smelt and hauling them around. And the seining guys, they're really working their tails off.
I bet.
But to some people, it's just great fun. And like you said, it is truly an up north Great Lakes tradition.
So these are not native to the Great Lakes. They originally were used as some forage fish. They're a saltwater fish, right? As are several of the species of the salmon swimming in the Great Lakes, too. So I'm not going to hold that against them. But they were used as some forage fish in some pond in the Lower Peninsula of Michigan. And they got out. They got into a river or something and got, you know, into Lake Michigan. And boom, they just exploded across the Great Lakes. You know, then what the salmon stocking actually knocked the smelt back quite a bit. Now they've maybe reached a bit of an equilibrium. Folks, they catch them for a couple of purposes. I, you know, we had one guy we quoted who said his grandpa used to use them as fertilizer on his potato farm. We've got bait dealers who go up there and use them. They sell them to bait shops so the guys can use them for hook and line. They're oily, right? They're stinky, so they're good for catching all sorts of fish. And then, yeah, we've got a lot of people like to catch them and actually clean them up and eat them.
I had a buddy that lived up in Herbstreit, Wisconsin, and he used to like to smelt. This was back in the late 80s that I'd go up with my buddy Randy. They're a great bait. Smelt are phenomenal bait. Dead bait, they work great for dragging around for pike. I fish Shawamigan Bay up on Lake Superior, and if you've got live smelt, which I actually, in August when the smelt move up to the big docks, I actually catch them with hook and line, very tiny hooks.
Not bad.
And I'm using dough balls that I make out of bread. And you know, little tiny trout hooks, and I catch these smelt, put them in my live well, and then I keep them in a live box on my dock. And I go into Shawamigan Bay, and I use them for smallmouth bass.
Oh, yeah.
You cannot beat live smelt on a drop shot rig. I guarantee you, if you've got 25, 30 smelt, you're going to catch 25, 30 bass.
Yeah, I believe it. They're, like I say, they're oily. They give off a lot of odor. I've used chunks of smelt while fishing pike and lake trout up in Canada, up in Ontario, for this, the same reasons that you describe. Anyway, the whole smelt phenomenon, check it out in this week's Outdoor News. Tim, we're going to break, but you'll be back at the end of the show?
I will.
All right, thank you. That was Tim Lesmeister. Appreciate him joining us. Let's go to commercial here, and when we return, I think we'll talk lake trout with our buddy Gord Ellis from Thunder Bay. Lots of cold water topics here today. Don't go away. More Outdoor News Radio after these messages.
From sunrise casts to sunset stories by the fire, Fireside Lodge is more than a fishing trip. It's an experience worth coming back to. Cast your line into pristine northwestern Ontario waters, reel in the catch of a lifetime, and unwind in comfort at the end of the day. Whether it's your first trip or an annual tradition, Fireside Lodge delivers the experience you've been waiting for. Book your 2026 adventure today at firesidelodge.com or call 1-800-545-0815.
For those walking the turkey woods this spring, carry a Bold Retay Gobbler shotgun. Top options include the Gordian Turkey Gun with its no-rattle Inertia Plus rotating bolt and factory-lengthened forcing cone, which delivers 20% more pellets. Or the Gamelander Turkey Single Shot, available in 410 and 20-gauge in black and mossy oak bottomland with its airy recoil reduction pad. Find a dealer locator at RetayUSA.com. That's RetayUSA.com. Be the Retay difference.
Spring coho at Steelhead are on, and Ken's is leading the charge on Lake Michigan. Fish with Wisconsin's number one Lake Michigan charter service, running out of three prime ports. Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, Sturgeon Bay, and Algoma, Wisconsin. Kick off the season with fast-paced rod-bending coho and steelhead action out of Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, where limit catches are the expectation, not the exception. Spots fill fast. Call 800-446-8605 or book online at www.kinscatch.com. That's Ken Sports Fishing. Your spring bite starts here.
Some of the best Minnesota trips happen on the water. With Rainy Lake Houseboats, you can rent a fully equipped houseboat and explore the shoreline of Rainy Lake near Voyageurs National Park. Spend the day fishing, swimming, or tying up in a quiet bay and cooking dinner on board. To reserve your houseboat, call 1-800-554-9188. That number again is 1-800-554-9188 or visit rainylakehouseboats.com.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
You know the drill. You got a free Saturday, the boat's ready, but you're scrolling through the same tired fishing reports trying to figure out where to go. Stop guessing and start catching. Onyx Fish lets you filter thousands of Midwest lakes by species, trophy potential, even keeper size, all backed by real DNR survey data. Plus, Onyx Fish is brand new on Android, so no more excuses. Try free for 7 days. Download Onyx Fish on the App Store or Google Play. Your next favorite lake is out there. Go find it.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreisline with you for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you liked the broadcast. If so, check us out online at outdoornews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. You can subscribe to our print or digital versions there. I want to talk about something that's going on right now that we don't discuss enough here, and that's lake trout. And then when we do talk lake trout, it's usually Lake Superior, but there are a lot of lakers on inland lakes in Minnesota and getting up into Ontario. And I know a guy who chases lake trout, especially across northwestern Ontario. He's a gentleman who's, I don't know if I ever remember having him on before. It's Mr. Gord Ellis. He is a big-time outdoors personality in Thunder Bay, Canada. He writes for Ontario Out of Doors. He also writes for a publication in the States called Northern Wilds. And his byline is in Outdoor News occasionally also. Gord, thanks a lot for joining me on the broadcast. Haven't talked to you in a while. Good to see you. You still got a little snow up there in Thunder Bay, huh?
We have a little bit, Rob, and it's great to talk to you again. But yeah, we've had a really long winter here in the Great White North, and I can actually see where I'm sitting.
I'll be darned. Well, and it's your walleye opener this weekend, the 16th, right?
Yeah, it's the walleye opener, and some of the lakes nearby Thunder Bay, especially to the north and northwest, there's still some ice on them. So it's going to be touch and go for some folks putting their boats in, and I expect some outfitters will probably have some issues, especially as you get way up north towards Red Lake and Air Falls and those areas, Nakina.
Well, this is a later ice out than normal, isn't it, for yes. your area? I mean, I used to get up and do the ice out lake trout thing before our opener here in Minnesota, like late April. So I actually think it's a good sign when things are running a little late with all the climate change we deal with. It's nice to see things a little colder than average once in a while.
What I've seen in the last probably decade is that our springs seem to be colder and draggier here, but our falls are unusually warm and will stay warm right into October. And I mean, there was a time where in the first week of October, if you shot a moose up here, you could hang it up in a tree for a week. You cannot do that anymore. So it just seems to have shifted to warmer weather later, but it's been a cold spring.
Well, let's talk about lake trout. What are lake trout doing right now? These are, as you referred to them, as denizens of the deep. Most of the year, these guys are in the deepest, coldest water. We talk about all trout species being cold water animals, cold water fish. That certainly applies hardcore to lake trout, doesn't it?
Yeah. So lake trout initially, well, in the wintertime, they can be just about anywhere because the water's cold, but they still will be deep often. So if you're fishing in the winter, you're often in 40 to 60 feet of water. As the ice goes out, the lakers will start to move shallow, but it takes a while. Like they don't just rush up into the shallows. It's interesting, this part of the world, like we can right now cast for brook trout really shallow in ice cold water, and you'll catch steelhead in ice cold water, but the lake trout aren't quite up yet. It takes a little while for them to nose up, but as it gets like into the mid 40s and pushing 50 Fahrenheit surface, then you see the lake trout slip up into the shallower stuff, and that's when you can get them in 10, 15, 20 feet of water, or even less sometimes.
You know, sometimes people hear shallows and they assume it's near shorelines.
Right.
When you're fishing these things, they may be way, way out in the middle of the lake, but they're just in that upper tier.
Right. They can be in the upper tier. They can also be on reefs. You know, some of the reefs will come up to 10 feet top on it, and they'll slip up on top of that. But there is a fair bit of shore fishing for lake trout in certain areas of northwestern Ontario, and I have certainly caught lots trolling along shoreline this time of year and into late May. Usually about a week, 10 days after ice out, it seems to be when the lake trout really start going. So we're just into it right now.
Is it popular? Are a lot of people chasing lakers this time of year?
I think it's less popular than it used to be, and I'm not quite sure why that is. Like, I can remember at one time up towards Sioux Lookout, Big Vermilion, Little Vermilion, and some of the lakes up in there, there would be just all sorts of people targeting spring lake trout. It still happens around Atikokan as well, which is just north of the Boundary Waters. There's lots of beautiful lakes there where people historically from Minnesota and other places would travel and fish lake trout. I don't think it's done as much now. Not sure if that's just a change in culture. I don't think it's necessarily because the fishing isn't any better, because we have good solid lake trout populations here. But, you know, what people fish for and how they fish for them changes over time. Mm-hmm. It's really, really interesting. And sometimes it doesn't, there's no actual reason for it. It's just a change in culture and how people fish.
This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline. We're chatting with Gord Ellis. He's out of Thunder Bay, Canada. We're talking about lake trout fishing in the spring. He's a guide as well as an outdoor scribe hailing from that part of Canada, from Ontario. So, Gord, let's say someone's listening. They want to try this. What are some tactics? What are some prime lures? How do you go about catching these lake trouts when they're in relatively shallow water right now? It differs than trying to catch them in August, I presume.
Yeah. So generally in August, you're fishing deeper, often with downriggers or lead core. You might use a heavy weight. Big jigs is another way to do it, which is actually a fun way to catch lake trout. And you can catch some deep this time of year. Like, it's not unusual to go onto a bay, say on Lake Nipigon in late May and find them in 40 feet of water. But they'll also potentially be in 10 feet of water. So it just depends on how you want to target them. And I'll often do what I call flatline trolling, which is without weight, weight of the spoon. Spoons like Williams Wobblers, Little Cleo's a classic. A lot of people like Daredevil, Eppinger Daredevil, just classic wobble spoons. You know, you're fishing 10, 15 feet of water. You might want to put a little, you know, half ounce rubber core or 1 ounce rubber core if you want to get it down a bit more. And you're just covering water that way. So that's, or another way to catch them is with a crankbait, like a shad wrap. They're very effective. Anything that's a minnow bait, if you're trolling, anything that looks like a minnow, because that's primarily what lake trout feed. They're primarily a piscivorous fish, so they'll like smelt and shiners and chubs and stuff like that. And then if you want to cast, you can still use spoons. Generally, you downsize it a bit, and they're more, classics, or like the Little Cleo or Castmaster. Or you can use jigs, which is a lot of fun. Love catching lake trout on jigs. And a tube jig is a classic, like a 4-inch tube jig with a half-ounce head is a classic. Also like bucktail jigs, different styles of bucktails that look like a smelt or a shiner. So a white and silver bucktail, maybe a 3/8 ounce, half ounce. And just work it, swim it, and just work it over the rocks. And they tend to hit very aggressively. Nice thing about lake trout is they are not shy about hitting.
We would troll, we'd make long S-curves, slow S-curves, going 2-3 miles an hour, trolling crankbaits or some of the spoons, and just trying to vary, you know, the depth to you, to you'd start to get some strikes. Now, of course, Gord, this was all in the era before forward-facing sonar, and I'm curious if FSS has become a big deal up in Canada the way it has down here. That was the mystery of lake trout fishing is where are these fish, you know, just trying to find them. Has that dynamic changed with forward facing sonar? I got to think suspended lake trout would put off a pretty good ping on a forward facing sonar, and it would be pretty easy to find.
So I will be honest here and tell you, I don't have one on my boat. I'm not saying I won't get one, but at this point I don't. Have I fished with people that have them? Absolutely. And you can certainly see lake trout suspended, as you can see any fish and target them. I seem to do well enough with the old school electronics and knowing the water. Again, I'm not saying that I won't ever get one, but I don't really normally have to go looking for lake trout too much. You know, if you have certain areas that you know they're on reefs or drop-offs, if they're anywhere near your lure, you're going to find out generally pretty quickly.
I was chatting with someone who was walleye fishing later in the summer and using forward-facing sonar, and commented to me just like, wow, those lake trout really stand out.
I'm sure they do. Yeah, because there's just so much surface area there.
Right.
I think if you were casting, like if you were casting jigs and they were out suspended, that would pretty, just like in a muskie or anything else, you can pretty effectively target them. Yeah.
Let's talk about eating lake trout. This is a species that sometimes doesn't have the greatest culinary reputation. Generally, people who live in lake trout range push back on that and say, hey, you know how to flame, you know how to cook them right, you can't beat them in the pan.
I do eat lake trout, and we eat lake trout in this house. We don't eat them like every week for various reasons, but I tend to barbecue them. Yeah, you should fill it off the fat sections, and there's that brown layer that's between the skin and the flesh. You should take that off. That tends to be a little fishy, but I like lake trout. It's a flavor. It's a trout. It's flavorful. Bigger ones I don't eat so much for as much reason as, you know, they bioaccumulate things. Sure. Lake trout live a long time. And so, you know, if you catch a 15 pound lake trout, it's probably 15 years old or more, and it's eaten a whole lot of smelt and other stuff that have some mercury. And so if you're concerned about that kind of thing, I don't eat a bigger fish. But a 3-pounder, like in the winter, I fish Lake Superior quite a bit, just outside of Thunder Bay, and we'll keep a 2-3 pound lake trout, and it's delicious.
Probably a good rule of thumb. Yeah, just release those big ones, keep the smaller ones for the pan. And their flesh kind of between a whitefish and a salmon, wouldn't you say? Kind of that middle range, orangish.
Yeah, and it's, you know, highly dependent on what they eat. Although I've caught lake trout that, you know, were stuffed with smelt, but the flesh was orange. So at some point they're eating other things. You know, they're eating freshwater shrimp or crayfish, and that they're getting keratin in their flesh. But yeah, I would say they're probably a little closer to salmon than whitefish. Whitefish is one of my favorite eating fish.
Yeah,
we're lucky to have a lot of them up here. That's, I think, close to number one. But lake trout are very edible.
Gord, thanks a lot for spending time with me. Good to catch up. Good to learn more about lake trout fishing. I learned some things from you here today. You're a guide also during the summer. If folks want to access your guide service, how can they find you?
They can find me at my website, gordellis.com. Pretty much booked up for this year, but 2027, I can be booked. And I do brook trout, lake trout, trophy pike, walleye, salmon, all sorts of good stuff.
Good. Well, I'm sure it's going to be a great year for you up there. As soon as that ice goes away, good luck with that.
Thank you, Rob. Great to talk to you.
As our buddy Gord Ellis, gordellis.com. If you're interested in learning more about what he's got cooking with his writing or his guiding, let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
Here's a way to give back to the future of waterfowl. Volunteer with Ducks Unlimited. From the Alaskan wilderness to the Atlantic Flyway, Ducks Unlimited has been protecting and restoring critical habitat for nearly 90 years. We're working toward our next million-acre milestone, and we need your help. Whether you're great at selling event tickets, securing donations, lining up sponsors, or pitching in wherever, there's a role for everyone. Join the team that's making a real difference. Head to ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
You know the drill. You got a free Saturday, the boat's ready, but you're scrolling through the same tired fishing reports trying to figure out where to go. Stop guessing and start catching. Onyx Fish lets you filter thousands of Midwest lakes by species, trophy potential, even keeper size, all backed by real DNR survey data. Plus, Onyx Fish is brand new on Android, so no more excuses. Try free for 7 days. Download Onyx Fish on the App Store or Google Play. Your next favorite lake is out there. Go find it.
Your land is your legacy. But keeping it healthy and thriving means caring for it now and in the future. The Family Forest Carbon Program can help you do right by your land with guaranteed income, help developing a forest management plan, and advice from experts. If you own 30 acres or more of forest land, you may be eligible to enroll in the Family Forest Carbon Program. Visit familyforestcarbon.org and enroll today.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
Some of the best Minnesota trips happen on the water. With Rainy Lake Houseboats, you can rent a fully equipped houseboat and explore the shoreline of Rainy Lake near Voyageurs National Park. Spend the day fishing, swimming, or tying up in a quiet bay and cooking dinner on board. To reserve your houseboat, call 1-800-554-9188. That number again is 1-800-554-9188 or visit rainylakehouseboats.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreisein is here for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning in. Fun broadcast as usual, and a lot of fun content in our print version of Outdoor News or our website. If you want to see what that's all about, go to outdoornews.com. You can subscribe or call us at 800-535-5191. Now, this week and next week, it's our friend Stan Tequila, naturesmart.com. He's the Backyard and Beyond columnist at Outdoor News, and it's truly a great time of year, isn't it, Stan? Migration still going. I mean, probably starting to wind down as we get into the heart of the nesting season, huh?
Yeah. So hi, Rob. Good to see you again. And yeah, we are like full bore. It's a little bit of everything's going on right now. So we've got things like the larger birds, like owls and eagles, who have already got young that are leaving the nest. And then we've got some things like geese and ducks who are just starting to hatch right now. We got robins that are starting to lay eggs. And yet we still have so many more birds to migrate into the area. So all the warblers are just really getting going. And then so we've got a big, long – so it's that kind of dynamic season that all sorts of things are happening all at once.
Stan, we were talking a little off air. Do you already have hummingbirds and orioles in the neighborhood?
Yes. They came in probably 5 days ago or 6 days ago or so, and they're doing well. In fact, just this morning, I was trying to photograph some orioles, and I counted at least five male Baltimore orioles that I've got coming into my feeders. So, and this is an easy thing to attract. You can attract these birds. They, even if you didn't have a feeder out before, if you put out a specific oriole-type feeder with some grape jelly in it, guaranteed you're going to get these orioles coming down because they'll spot it right away and they'll come right in with it. So it's well worth your time and effort to try to attract in orioles.
And both those species, they come from a long ways away, right?
Yeah, these are true neotropical migrants. So they're down in central, sometimes South America for the wintertime, and they make their way all the way back up here to the upper Midwest and for their breeding. And this is something that maybe a lot of people don't understand, is that they come here to nest. They do not nest when they're down south in the tropics in the wintertime. They come here, only here, to nest. That should be a kind of a little light bulb should be going off in your head right now. That's how important your habitat is in your yard and what you provide for them. And so these birds are looking for this. They come here, they nest, and then they, you know, at the end of the season, they turn around and they head south again and they rest all winter long.
How far south do orioles go? If I'm down in Mexico or Costa Rica, I mean, how far south would I go to see an oriole in the winter?
As you know, Rob, I lead photo tours to Costa Rica in the wintertime, generally November and December and in March. And every time I'm in Costa Rica during those months, the orioles are there. You know, and it's really fun to see them because there they are. And yet knowing that, you know, they go way back up to where we're at in the summertime, it's kind of cool to see them there. By the way, when they're there, they call them their birds.
Sure.
And and when they're here, we call them our birds, you know.
Right. So you see them in March, and Blake, you say they're already here by early May. Do you ever have anybody on your photo tour that say, hey, let's look for their nest when you're down in Costa Rica?
I guess I haven't had that, but that would be an assumption that somebody might make, that these birds are nesting there also. And I don't know why. It just seems like a basic thing to me, but if it's basic to me, it may not be basic to everybody else, in the fact that these birds are not nesting twice a year. I've tried to look to see, is there a species anywhere that migrates, nests, and then migrates again and nests. And I've yet to find one. I mean, there may be, I mean, there's almost 11,000 species of birds. So, and 40% of those migrate. So there's a fair amount that, you know, are, that could be doing that, could be migrating. And I just don't know. I haven't checked all of them to see if that were to be possible, but I highly doubt it.
You know, from a bird's perspective, there's a lot of energy that goes into developing eggs, right? So, you know, we might think, gosh, Costa Rica, this is great. Look at all this food. This is a great place to nest. And it's like, well, that bird's got to gear up for that biologically.
Yeah. And they've got a long way to go when they get there. So there's so much to talk about with this whole, this topic. Because these birds, they have to be in the right breeding condition. They just can't, for lack of a better comparison, compared to people. People can get pregnant at any time of year. Birds cannot. Their reproductive system is only functioning for a short period of time each year. In addition to that, even with birds, only the left ovary works in birds. Even though they have two, we don't know why the right ovary doesn't work. So it's just one of these oddball things.
Wow, I never knew that one, Stan. That's wild. Yeah. This is Outdoor News Radio. Rob Gerisline talking with our friend Stan Tequila, NatureSmart.com, about non-game topics. Stan joins us here periodically on the broadcast. Back up here in Minnesota, we've got goslings on the ground already. Someone, I think, in the last couple of days of April said they'd seen some. And then I saw some goslings, just tiny little guys. I think it was on May 1st. But they'll put weight on quickly, won't they?
Oh, they'll grow very quickly. Yeah, and I saw a pair this morning that only had three goslings, but these goslings were really big. And I thought, well, geez, three. That means they've probably lost six or eight of them already. And but these little ones were not little anymore. So they probably hatched in the latter part of April. Over the weekend, I went to a seminar about Aldo Leopold, and they were talking about for those of who don't know Aldo Leopold, he's kind of like the father of conservation, and started in the 1920s and on up through the 1940s, and basically habitat restoration and how to so on and so forth. Rob, I'm sure you're familiar with Aldo Leopold and his Sand County Almanac book and all that.
Yeah, I've read it multiple times.
Yeah, so I was attending this seminar and they were talking about this, and he was a great record keeper, phenology of what day did the geese hatch, you know, like we're talking now, or what day did this. This goes, and he covers from most of the 20s, 30s, and into the 1940s. And interestingly, his daughter then did the same exact thing in the same area through the 1970s, 80s, and into the 90s.
And was that Nina Leopold Bradley, or the other daughter? I forget. Yes. The other, Estella, was that the other daughter?
I think it's Nina. And took the data from father and the daughter, and they compared them against each other. And they're showing that on average, it's anywhere from 4 to like 8 or 10 days that things are happening now. Flowers are blooming earlier. Birds are migrating earlier. Insects are out. Different, you know, and it was just an interesting thing to look at and compare general observations from the same area, two different people, obviously, but over a big, long period of time, and to look at that and see this big change that we're seeing in the environment as things go along. And so we will continue to see more and more of these changes and more things like this evolving over time.
Well, and to be clear, this is climate change. This is because our winters are not as long, and we're having warmer summers, warmer springs, warmer falls.
Yeah, it's the whole, you know, it's one big thing. You know what I'm saying? It's one big typical analogy is the spider web. You know, you pluck one strand in the web, and it, you know, vibrates throughout the entire web. And that's exactly how this is. Everything is being changed, or being affected, I should say, by the change of the climates.
Stan, one other nesting item. I know you had your great horned owl nesting platform out. How did they do? How big of a brood did they pull off?
So, for those who don't know, I've got a pair of great horned owls who've been nesting in my property for the last 5 years.
And it's in West Metro, right?
It's at my lake place, so it's a north kind of central Minnesota. And I had last October decided to put a camera on that nest and live streamed it 24/7, started February 4th, and it went till May 6th or something like that, or 5th or something like that. And they laid three eggs, hatched all three of them. But the youngest one, we had a stretch of 4 or 5 days of cold, cold, wet weather, and the littlest one couldn't make it through that. So, but the other two did make it. We've named these birds because we had such an amount of people watching, and everybody wanted to know, you know, and they were starting to make up names and things like that. So I said, well, let's just give them names. That way it's, you know, stays consistent. But Sage was the oldest of the hatchlings, and then Sky was the next one, and the two of them made it to the very end, and they fledged, meaning that they left the nest. And with great horned owls, soon as they leave the nest, they're done. They don't come back. So they left, and the first one left one day, and about 2.5-3 days later, the second one left, and so which left us all literally empty nesters. We had thousands of people watching this this live stream on YouTube, and they were just gone, and everybody was like, oh my gosh, what happened? Where are they? And all that. So I've been like wondering myself. Last night, I was out about 11 o'clock last night, and we have the big patch of woods, and I could hear both of the babies begging for food off into the woods. So I was like, oh, thank goodness that they've survived.
That's exactly
so
what
far.
They should be doing is begging for food from their parents, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And these babies will continue to beg food from their parents until August, September. I've seen them as far as late as October trying to do it. So the parents will feed them all summer long too.
Well, good. I'm going to thank you for the update. If folks want to, obviously they can't watch the platform now, but maybe next winter they can, right?
That's correct. So we'll start it up again next year. It's on YouTube. It's Nature Smart Media. And I do have a bunch of shorts there and things people can go and see.
Stan, thanks so much for joining me this week. You'll return with us on next week's broadcast.
All right. Sounds good. Talk to you then.
There's our buddy. Yeah, Stan Tequila. Check out what he's got cooking at naturesmart.com. Let's break more of the broadcast after these messages.
Your hunt starts with healthy wetlands and the habitats that support them. From the Alaskan wilderness to the Atlantic Flyway, across America's Great Plains and down the Mississippi Delta, Ducks Unlimited has protected and restored habitat for nearly 90 years. We need your help to reach our next million-acre milestone and ensure waterfowl for generations to come. Whether you're selling tickets, securing donations, or finding that next sponsor, there's a role for everyone. Join today at ducks.org/volunteer. Ducks Unlimited. Conservation for a continent.
Spring coho at Steelhead are on, and Ken's is leading the charge on Lake Michigan. Fish with Wisconsin's number one Lake Michigan charter service, running out of three prime ports. Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, Sturgeon Bay, and Algoma, Wisconsin. Kick off the season with fast-paced, rod-bending coho and steelhead action out of Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, where limit catches are the expectation, not the exception. Spots fill fast. Call 800-446-8605 or book online at www.kinscatch.com. That's Ken Sports Fishing. Your spring bite starts here.
There are lakes across Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and beyond that are loaded with fish. And nobody's talking about them. Onyx Fish helps you find them. Search by species, filter for big walleye, trophy panfish, or eater crappies. Check satellite imagery, depth maps, and public access points, all before you leave the house. And now, Onyx Fish is available on Android for the first time. iPhone, Android, doesn't matter. Just download it and start planning. 7-day free trial, then just $35 a year. Onyx Fish. Find new lakes, get there with confidence.
Now is the perfect time to plan your 2026 shoreline or stream bank restoration project. Native plantings provide functional beauty while reducing erosion, limiting runoff, and improving the quality of the water you love. Whether you're a homeowner or a lake association, Minnesota Native Landscapes has the knowledge, experience, and tools to do it right. Site assessment appointments are filling fast. Visit us at mnlcorp.com. That's mnlcorp.com.
From sunrise casts to sunset stories by the fire, Fireside Lodge is more than a fishing trip. It's an experience worth coming back to. Cast your line into pristine northwestern Ontario waters, reel in the catch of a lifetime, and unwind in comfort at the end of the day. Whether it's your first trip or an annual tradition, Fireside Lodge delivers the experience you've been waiting for. Book your 2026 adventure today at firesidelodge.com or call 1-800-545-0815.
Like every serious angler in this region, I want to make the most of my time on the water. That's why I read OutdoorNews.com. This all-new digital resource is loaded with valuable tips, lake profiles, up-to-date fishing reports, gear reviews, and breaking news on laws and regulations that affect the sports we love. Plus, OutdoorNews.com will help you catch more and bigger fish. Be prepared and get ahead of the crowd. Join OutdoorNews.com today.
Everybody, welcome back. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreisein and Tim Lesmeister with me here again for final segment of this week's broadcast. You can read us both at OutdoorNews.com or in the print version of Outdoor News. You can subscribe to either one of those at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. Tim, some national topics I wanted to talk with you about before we wrap up this week's show. First off, last week we didn't really get to this topic. I think it really started to boil over after we recorded. We had a couple bear attacks out west. Oh, I believe they almost happened on the same day, one in Yellowstone and one in Glacier National Park. This doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's a big headline. I think it had been 30 years since we'd had a fatality in Glacier.
Yeah, you know, it's always sad when somebody gets out there in the woods and they get attacked by a bear. And I always wonder what preparation they took, what kind of stuff they had on them as far as bear spray, or, you know, some people have found that you can carry these horns that you have in boats, you know, that they're like a compressed air can and they've got one of those horns on it. And if a bear starts to charge you, you blast it with this horn, it'll stop it long enough that you can get some bear spray, you know, cranked up and fired into its eyes. So I'm actually going to Alaska here in just a couple of weeks, And while I'm up there, that's one of the things I'm going to add to my belt. When I'm in Alaska, I've got a 50 caliber Desert Eagle on my chest, which I hope I never have to use. And I carry two cans of bear spray, one on each side, depending upon which hand is loose. And now I'm going to add to that, on that belt that I wear, I'm going to add a couple of one of those horns that we have in our boats that blast that loud, piercing noise. And I hope that works if I need it. But you bear encounters, boy, you got to be prepared.
Tim, when you're running around Alaska, I hope you're never solo. Even though you are pretty heavy with guns and bear spray and now maybe a horn, that's what jumped out at me, I guess, about the glacier story especially, was this person was by himself. And I want to be respectful. I'm sorry what happened, but I can't imagine running around Glacier National Park solo. That is just a recipe for danger with these animals. I believe there is no recorded incident of a bear attack on a group of four or more people in the history of Lake North America. Now, listen, I certainly have walked Yellowstone and Glacier with two people, so that can happen too. But the more people you have with you, the odds of having a serious bear encounter drop dramatically.
Yeah, I'm never alone in the woods up in the Alaskan areas that I go to. You know, it's funny that you talk like that. It was a day that we decided to take a couple kayaks on a trail into a lake that had a Forest Service cabin on it. My son was with me, Jason, and I was in the lead going into this lake. I'm pulling a kayak on portage wheels, and I got quite a bit ahead of Jason. He was stopping to look at stuff. He's a hunter, you know, he always wants to check things out. And I was just probably about 35, 40 yards from where it opened up into the lake, and I heard something behind me. I thought it was Jason. I turned around and looked, and this big, huge bull moose had stepped out onto the trail. I'm more afraid of moose up in Alaska than I am bears. And you could see this thing didn't like me on its trail, and it started giving me the evil eye. And I could see that it very well could have gotten ornery enough to maybe charge me. So, of course, I positioned my kayak between me and the moose. But as soon as the moose started looking like he might do something stupid, as I'm pulling my sprays out and stuff, my son started yelling at it. And as soon as he did, this moose turned and looked at him, turned back and looked at me and said, you know what? There's two of them here. I'm not going to mess around. And it ran into the woods.
Right.
So you're right. Having two people worked a lot better than just me, because I think by myself, I might have had to deal with a charge.
Yeah. Well, there's obviously some chatter about bear populations. I guess that's inevitable. There was some debate about bear populations, grizzly bear populations out there even before this happened. To me, this is not carte blanche to go crazy and say we've got to, you know, crack down on the number of bears. But spring especially, right? These bears are probably in a pretty surly mood, right? They're hungry.
Oh, they're hungry.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, look at the cougar attacks. Almost always a runner, always solo.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. All right, well, this kind of ties into another related topic. We had a story, I think, on page 4 this week, Tim, regarding whether or not, well, it's not regarding whether or not, apparently the Trump administration is loosening rules for hunting in national parks and wilderness areas. And, you know, this gets into a number of topics you and I have discussed in the past. Isle Royale, for example. We've talked about how, you know, one reason you really can't have hunters try to help manage the moose population in Isle Royale because we don't allow hunting in national parks for the most part. I'm not in favor of carte blanche hunting in the national parks. I do not want hunters out killing buffalo or elk or bears in Yellowstone or Glacier or these places. I don't think that helps the cause of hunting. I think it would actually hurt the cause. But I do think there's some room for places like Isle Royale where, okay, most of the tourists are gone by mid-September. If we have more flexible rules, could we have a few guys go in there and have a wilderness moose hunt experience to help manage moose again? Because the wolves are going to crash, as we were discussing last week, that the wolf population is going to crash again. Then the moose population will bounce back up. Maybe we should consider allowing a little bit of hunting up there. From that standpoint, I'm not completely opposed to maybe loosening some of these rules.
Yeah, I think he's looking to try and create a constituency of hunters.
Yes.
And
that's a lot of it too. Yeah,
it's typically what they do.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
It's like, what are we going to do to add some more votes to our
right
tally? And so they're thinking maybe they can go after the hunters.
You're absolutely spot on, Tim, when you say the idea here is they're trying to appeal to some demographics, and they're trying to, hey, hunt, look at hunters, look what we're doing for you here.
But as soon as they do something like this, then they turn around and put some guy in charge of the BLM that wants to basically sell all the property that you'd be hunting on.
Right, right, yeah. And that ties into another point. That was early this past week. I think on Monday night, they were even reporting that this guy had the job, and then all these reports were being pulled on Tuesday morning. It was funny, Tim. I was researching it, and I was clicking all these stories that said, this story is gone, or you've gone to the wrong spot. And I was like, is something wrong with my computer? I've never had this happen. Well, all these reporters got it wrong Monday night. It was a procedural vote to advance his nomination, not to lock in his nomination. As we speak, who knows what, maybe he is even locked in. You're talking about Stephen Pierce.
Yeah.
Was he a Colorado congressman?
New Mexico,
who was very open as a congressman. We need to sell off public lands to balance the budget, which has become, I mean, that argument, Tim, has become even more ridiculous.
We don't have $1 trillion worth of public land.
No.
No, definitely don't have $20 trillion.
And especially when you see the federal budget deficit, I think, has gone up $3 trillion in the past year, you know, with wars and whatever else this administration is up to. And they're talking about, we've got to be fiscally responsible by selling off, you know, our public spaces that the American public uses. And, you know, beyond that, have very important environmental benefits.
And I was just looking at another story in the this week's print edition that talked about how we're seeing fewer hunters. There was an interview with the individual that's in charge now of the mentoring program for bringing in young people to the outdoor sports. And he was saying that a lot of the reason that we don't have more young hunters enter this is because we don't have land access for them. And I think if you start selling off public lands and you don't have land access for these individuals that might want to get out there and do some hunting, then we got a problem. So I don't have a problem opening up some of these areas for hunting because we need that access. But it's not going to do any good if you're selling it off.
Right.
So, you know, there's a fine line here that we have to tread. And I think that we got to look at this as a big picture program and not, do crazy things.
And I think a lot of people don't understand. There's some backlash to this, and some of those folks don't understand. There's already hunting in like wilderness areas, for example. I moose hunted in the Boundary Waters 25 years ago.
Oh, I used to grouse hunt up there every fall.
Right, yeah. You can grouse hunt up there right now. You can deer hunt up there. You can't moose hunt because there's no state moose season.
Right.
But a lot of your western wilderness areas, that's where a lot of backcountry type of hunting happens right now. So there's some backlash to this. Like, oh my God, you're going to open up all these wilderness areas to hunting. Well, a lot of them are open now. And, you know, some of these headlines, some of what the Trump administration is doing is just kind of locking in what's already existing so they can get a nice headline out of it and try to appeal to the hunting demographic.
Right. Yeah. Well, you're going to see a lot of this going on now between now and November with the midterms, everybody vying for their seat. And it's going to be who do we have to kowtow to now to generate a few votes?
Thank you for bringing up that Stephen Pierce thing because, you know, yes, we can do a little kowtowing, as you just said, but look at what's really going on behind the scenes, trying to get guys like Stephen Pierce into positions of power. That's the most worrisome thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think when Teddy Roosevelt, from his term on, we've had some real good presidents as far as making sure that we had a lot of lands that were developed for recreation.
Yeah. We want to hold on to that. Well, Tim, thank you. A couple fun segments as usual. I hope you have a good time fishing farm ponds in Iowa. We'll talk to you next week.
I can't wait.
Thank you to Tim, all of our other guests. Everybody have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerisline signing off for Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.